don't think this.
Pull it together, Jono. Come on, you can do it. Come on. Focus.
I don't think there's one.
Use the force. Come on, Jono, you can do it.
I can.
You can.
Too hard.
Believe in yourself. Come on.
Welcome to Lug Radio.
Yeah, you crazy cats.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah.
My name is John O'Bacon, and I'd like to introduce you to our show. What is your name, brother?
Brother, my name is Stuart Langer.
What is your name, man with no testicles?
I'm Blue Matt, Blue Note Matt, the crazy cat from Essex.
And what is your name, No Hair McGraw?
I am the Vulture.
Okay, let's talk about Bill Hilf.
Microsoft Linux guy.
Yeah.
Turbo Cash, my brother.
We want to hear, man, about open source projects, man.
And yeah. How to fund them. And what about some stuff about our crazy get-together next year?
Hey, that's the Lug Radio lie.
Hi, Bill, you're on Lug Radio.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Brilliant. So, thanks for coming on the show. Tell us first of all,
who you are.
What you do. Tell us who you are, why the hell you're on our show, and what you do for Microsoft.
You bet. And thanks for having me on the show. I'm excited. I've been listening to the show for a long while.
Really?
Oh, wow.
This is fun. My name's Bill Hilf. I'm the Director of Platform Technology Strategy at Microsoft. I run our open source software technical strategy group. A bit about my background, I've been in the Linux and open source space for quite a while, about 13, 14 years.
Yeah.
In a variety of different roles, different companies, including IBM and a variety of companies that I did prior to that, a lot of dot-coms and
sure.
Other software companies.
Excellent. And you said you've worked at IBM and you're now working at Microsoft. What was it that attracted you to Microsoft?
So I was at IBM doing similar work, actually, Linux and open source strategy. And as my career is in software development, I started off as a pretty crummy programmer, actually, but that's how I was living for a while. Actually, most of my career was involved with writing software. So Microsoft, as the largest software developer in the world, was always an interesting company to me.
Yeah, sure.
If I was working in Unix or Linux or whatever.
Yeah.
And so the idea of understanding how software gets built on this scale has always been technically interesting to me. And so that's what really drew me here. Also, partly was understanding, having spent a lot of time in open source and understanding some of the phenomenons of open source and how Microsoft would deal with those phenomenons seemed like a great time to join the company in this role.
Absolutely. Now, you say that you're part of the Microsoft's open source strategy platform or platform strategy company. Up until about 2 minutes ago, I didn't even realize they had one. How big is it?
So it's not actually that big. We're what you might call an overlay group. So I have a team of people who work for me. Most of those folks come from the open source community in different types of ways. Some of them have been creators of popular Linux distributions. For example,
Gentoo.
Daniel Robbins, the creator of Gentoo Linux,
yep.
Right. Yeah, okay.
Works for me. Some are very specific. I have a couple guys who are very, very deep in the security space or as it relates to Linux and open source, and basically a collection of open source hackers. It's good guys.
Okay.
And so we're a relatively small team. We're less than, I have some contract people who come on and come off at different points, but we're always less than 15 people or so.
Right.
But our idea is not to be a tremendously large team, but to be a small, experienced and focused team that can think through some of the tougher strategy issues around open source.
Sure, yeah.
So we work across all the different product groups at Microsoft.
Okay. You've just spent a couple of minutes there describing how you've worked with open source software, how the guy who invented Gentoo works for you and so on and so forth. I suspect a reasonable portion of our listeners will be saying,
how is he working at Microsoft, where you've got, you know, Steve Ballmer described the GPL as being un-American and as a cancer? How do you reconcile the fact that you're keen on the open source development model, it's a way of cheating the profit and all that, with the fact that you work for Microsoft?
Sure, that's a great question. It's something I get asked all the time.
Fancy that.
There's a couple things I should probably set context on. First and foremost, I think Microsoft over the past few years has evolved quite a bit in its understanding of open source software in the general. In terms of, you know, open source in this context, I mean the software, but also the development model, the licensing models, the business models. I think Microsoft's become a lot more mature in its thinking around that phenomenon. Not to discredit any comments ever made, but, you know, sometimes comments get made 5-6 years ago.
Sure,
at different companies that, you know, are like gum on the shoe.
They always never
stick
forgotten.
Stick around.
Yeah, yeah.
However, there is... When people ask the question, how did you end up here and what do you do, my job is to look very objectively at both open source as well as our software assets. And we have, as you can imagine, a pretty big catalog of software assets.
Yeah.
And the way that we develop software is as equally as important as the software we produce and valuable. Is to look at all of these different dynamics in the software development world and the business models around that and say, are there areas that we compete? Sure, there's lots of areas that we have products. You know, we compete with SUSE Linux. We have a server product called Windows Server, right? And they have pretty much head-to-head competition. What I mean by that is, in many cases, customers are going to choose one or the other.
Sure, yeah.
Sometimes
yeah.
both, but it's a competitive space. But there's also, as much as my time is spent on what are the opportunities, what are the areas, and that's not necessarily just interoperating, not just working together, but what are the business opportunities for Microsoft in this space?
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, this campus, I sit here in Redmond, is a business. You know, it's not we're here to make money like any other commercial business. So we're looking at it through the lens of what's the opportunity here for us long term. And that's kind of where when people sort of understand that that those two sides of that coin of understanding of why we look at it this way and looking at it in an objective way. So I'm very rarely a pro Linux guy or very rarely just a pro only Windows guy.
Sure,
I like to understand the technology as it best fits a solution or solves a problem.
Yeah.
So the guys on my team and the lab, we have a large lab here on my team with lots and lots of servers and different configurations. What we try to do is take a really scientific approach to understanding all this so that we understand the reality of it, not just that mythology and, you know, the religion around all of these debates.
Excellent. Interoperability is a subject that a lot of people talk about when they talk about relations with Microsoft in different ways. And there's a guy over here in the UK who works at Microsoft who is called Head of Platform Strategy, but I think he's a different type of role to yourself. And I had a meeting with him once, and he said that Microsoft were the most interoperable software company.
Do you remember his name?
He's called Nick McGrath.
Oh, yeah, Nick's a good friend.
And he's a really nice chap, and he puts a good face on Microsoft in the UK. And we were talking, and I looked at him a little bit sort of suspiciously when he said that Microsoft were the most interoperable software company, because a lot of people complain about not being able to interoperate with Microsoft software. So with the recent announcement of Microsoft's XML file format and everything for going to ECMA, how are Microsoft trying to interoperate with systems such as Linux and Mac OS X and not just ignore that they exist?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, interoperability is a word like it's almost like open source. It can mean a lot of different things, depending on the context. I'll give you a couple different examples. When I look at the history of Microsoft and the success of Microsoft as a company, I think two of the key ingredients for Microsoft's success were building a common API that lots of developers could write applications to, and also building an operating system that could run on pretty much any piece of x86-based hardware. Those two things really help the growth of Microsoft. You might actually even call that being able to interoperate with any type of hardware or any type of app. But okay. Some people might not. Some people might say, no, interoperability means different systems talking together.
Right.
So there could be issues around defining this word. When I look at, you know, when someone like Nick, I'm not understanding the context of how he presented it, but there are, if you look at just how different things work together, be it software to software,
yeah,
operating system to operating system, hardware to hardware, even at a higher level, data to data or business process to business process across systems,
I really
try to look at it architecturally versus just saying generically interoperability. Because, I've worked with a lot of customers over the years, and I've been a customer for actually longer than I've been part of vendors such as IBM or Microsoft. And you never make a generic interoperability architecture, right? You have data that's exchanged, or you have, a Java app talking to a .NET app or vice versa. All these different, NFS, right? NFS doesn't need to interoperate at the hardware level,
I suspect there will be a few people listening to this who would say that Microsoft's definition of interoperability is that you define stuff and then other people implement it, and therefore you're interoperable.
Samba.
To pick an example, the Office XML file format, when there was already the ODT format out there. That's not necessarily a view that everyone shares, but do you feel that Microsoft or your team or whatever would see interoperability as leading the way? Or as implementing and working with standards that already exist?
I think there's both, to be honest with you. I'll give you real examples of both. There's both where I think that we are at the forefront, along with others, in defining new standards in an environment. Probably the best example I can think of are the web services specs. I would probably say between us and IBM, a lot of the leadership and thought leadership in defining those specs is being done by people at Microsoft and IBM. I think there's other areas that we clearly followed the standards to say, yes, this is a standard we must work with. I'll give you some real easy ones,
TCP/IP,
HTTP, NFS, NIS. I mean, I can go on and on and on down the stack. LDAP. Right, there's lots of things that were already existed in the marketplace that we adopted and interoperated with. So let me give you a product example of something recent of how this really comes to bear in one of our products.
Okay.
So we have a product called the Systems Management Server. It's a Microsoft management product that allows us to deploy patches to other Microsoft clients and servers. So when I come in, like for this is a good example, this morning. I had an update saying I need to install Office 12, the beta, because we have to, what we call dogfooding our own software before we release it.
Yeah, sure.
For better or worse, I get to use it first.
Yeah.
Now, the way that happens is there's a centralized server that communicates with these other clients and servers.
Yeah.
These are communicating with Microsoft products to Microsoft endpoints. When that product was being built a few years ago, they could have created it in a way that it only communicated with Microsoft products in a black box type of environment.
Hmm.
But instead, they created it using a standard protocol, actually an open protocol, so that it could communicate over this protocol called OpenWebM, WBEM, for web-based enterprise management.
Does that mean it's going to be a Linux client?
So let me finish the story.
Okay.
So today, it works fine. It all communicates over this protocol just fine. So some other software developers outside of Microsoft, actually had nothing to do with Microsoft, said, that's interesting. I wonder if I could write a client for Linux or Unix or Mac that communicated over this protocol back to that systems management server.
Okay,
and if so, then could I use the same sort of features and functionality, things like deploying patches, like RPM patches, or deploying or doing inventories of all my systems over this open protocol? And they did, and a couple of them started businesses, and one of those businesses got bought by Quest, a big software company here in the U.S. And now today, in my lab, with about 250 different servers, 40 different distributions of Linux on every type of hardware you can imagine, including lots of Unix and Macs in the environment, I manage all of that with a Microsoft management product. I have probably five Windows machines out of 250. But
that's
my management
cool.
product is from Microsoft. I'm able to use these other non-Windows platform agents to have a truly mixed interoperable environment, probably more mixed than anyone would reasonably have in a lab. So there are real examples of how we've used protocols that we didn't design.
Are those clients available for us?
What's that?
Are those clients available for anyone?
So again, we didn't make the clients, the client software. A company called Ventella made the clients. They sell them. They sell the client software.
Right, right.
But again, there's nothing special that we did with them. All the interesting work they did on their own, they developed a commercial business around it.
Oh, nice one. Okay. Yeah. Just slightly different tack. There's a lot of feeling, not just within the open source free software world, but throughout IT enthusiasts in general, that there's kind of a faction of people who see Microsoft as being more than a company. They see them as a representation of all that is evil and the manifestation of, you know, Hell's Army on Earth or something like that.
There are
people out there who feel that passionately, and I don't feel that way, but, you know, there are people who do feel that way.
Oh, trust me, I've met the majority of them.
what do you say to people like that? Because, you know, obviously you've only been in Microsoft for a couple of years, and you've worked in quite a few different places, so you've seen both sides. What do you say to the kind of more raving kind of side of society when they talk to you about, what they perceive as being the things wrong with Microsoft?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll tell you, before I took this job, my wife asked me, she said, let me get this straight, Bill. She goes, you're going to be the open source guy at Microsoft after spending your career in open source, and then you're going to go out publicly around the world and get in front of people claiming you're the Microsoft open source guy. She goes, you're going to get tarred and feathered from town to town.
Yeah, absolutely. You're going to
be throwing tomatoes at you wherever you go. I've been, you know, working in the space for a long time, so I have a lot of friends in the space as well, a lot of developer friends in the open source community. And, of course, I put a lot of thought into that. But once people understood sort of what my mission was and what I'm trying to do here, it became a lot more clear to them, and they were a lot more receptive. And I could say today I have a much stronger network of friends and relationships in the open source space than I did before I joined Microsoft. Which probably would surprise some people. Now, there's always going to be that fringe of people who just think that Microsoft represents. And let's just be honest here. I mean, Microsoft has been very, very successful and represents a large degree of successful capitalism. There's a lot of people who just use this as a whipping post because of that, right? Regardless if they like our software or not, right? It's just who we stand for. And Microsoft understands that. Right? We understand there's going to be that factionism. But I'll tell you, once, I was going to speak in Canada at a Linux user group, actually a local Linux user group in, I think, Montreal.
Yeah.
And before I was going to speak, and we sold the room out, we had 300 people in there, bought them all dinner, and I presented to them for about an hour and a half. And on the lug mail list, you know, a couple of weeks before, there was all this debate about what they're going to throw at me, and they're going to take the free food and run out.
Nice.
And they're
going to
do this and that. And our local Microsoft Canadian guys reading this said, "Oh my God, Bill's going to get killed." And I said, "Oh, no, it's okay. I understand these groups. Actually, I've been going to Linux user groups for 10 years. I mean, I know this audience. And I got in there and I was honest with them to describe what we're doing and why we're doing it. And guess what? We are going to compete on some fronts, but we're also going to try to find some opportunities together. And we're going to try to be a lot more open and transparent about what we're doing in this community. Then it becomes a lot more understanding, and no one threw anything and no one ran out of the room.
Cool.
So I feel it's been pretty well received overall. But you're always going to have that anything but Microsoft mentality.
Sure. Talking of how you're the face of Microsoft in front of Linux people, when you're at work at Microsoft, are you the face of the Linux people? I mean, how do they treat you? Are you the Microsoft enemy, sort of thing?
No, it's funny because I thought there was actually an article written about me, and the title was "Not the Loneliest Guy in Redmond." Before I took the job, I thought that maybe just because of who I was, I would be very lonely here or spited. But it's actually been the reverse. You got to remember, Microsoft's a very technically oriented company. It's largely run by technologists, and it's very engineering focused. In all fairness, IBM, I thought IBM's a great company. I loved working there, but it's a very sales oriented company. So when you come to a company that's very technically oriented, it's not a big surprise to that many of the people here already understood sort of the dynamics of open source and were really interested. And I actually had more people who wanted to talk to me in my first 6 months than I ever expected.
Right.
And now it's been very good because I often do represent, not just me, but my team represents that face of the Linux and open source community. So let's say...
Gotcha. Okay, a slightly separate question I wanted to ask was the dream of a lot of open source developers is that all software will be open source at some point. Do you think the world could work, speaking as, you know, an open source advocate, but someone who draws his salary from a company who have made a business out of taking software and exchanging it for money, do you think that a world where all software is open source can work, or do you think there has to be commercial software?
So I believe pretty strongly in the Microsoft business model. I believe it produces good software and sells it in volume at a good price. Otherwise, I wouldn't have taken a job here. So I want to be clear on that. It's not that I don't believe that what Microsoft is doing is right. Now, when I think about the future of software, I think there will always be a need for lots of different development models because open source is really at its heart a development model.
Yeah.
I think there's always going to be a need for that. But I know, for example, some of the things that we do for some types of software development that just wouldn't fit the open source development model. Some of the testing that we have to do and making sure that products are going to work in the type of volume that we distribute it as. Just to give you an example, we have lots of people who use Windows XP today, probably close, if I were just to guess, probably close to about 500 million users. No one in the world makes software for that many users. So we have to do a lot of things here behind the scenes to make sure that these things are tested very comprehensively across multiple devices, multiple environments. So there are certain things and processes we have in place I think will need to exist for a certain type of product. I do think that open source development is extremely efficient in certain types of areas. Mm. So I think there's always going to be this mix of different development models. I think some are going to have the co-licensing model or often the dual licensing model. Some are going to have a pure commercial model. Some are, if you look at like companies like Sugar CRM, where they have a really interesting model where they have the software is open source and then the commercial version has support and services, but also has some extensions to it as well.
Right.
All these different models out there, people trying out different ways of building and selling software.
Yeah.
Not just selling software, but finding ways to recoup that investment. Because at the end of the day, you still have to pay people to write software. If I look at the people who develop the kernel today, if I look at the top 150 people, most of them don't work for free. Most of them are getting employed by an IT vendor somewhere, IBM or HP or Oracle or somebody.
Okay, yeah.
And those that aren't are usually at a university.
Yeah.
So it's not a world works for free type of environment. I think most people are coming to that reality. So there's going to be different ways of supporting people, you know, so they can put food on the table and support their family and pay a mortgage and still write software. What they write that software for, be it commercial, open source, whatever it may be, is defined by the problems they're trying to solve. If you look at, let's say, the top, you know, the interesting exercise for the reader, I guess, would be sit down and really write the list of the top 15 open source applications today. And you can define top however you want, you know, most brand recognition, most downloads. And then try to do that, go back 2-3 years and try to go back and write that list again. And you'll see a lot of those haven't really changed. There have been newcomers, certainly, but a lot of the fundamental ones, Apache, MySQL, Linux,
maybe Samba, maybe in the server space, surely, but not in the desktop space.
You're correct. You can see this trend of some that have been very, very successful, and they're not successful by chance. It's because they fit a real need, a very specific type of need, quite well, and the development model matched that very well.
Yeah, sure. Bill, I mean, let's be, you know, you're a nice chap, and you've come on the show, and you listen to the show, and, you know, we all like you here, so let's speak informally. You know, you work at Microsoft, you work in an interesting role at Microsoft. What do you want to see happen there? What if you had, you know, Bill's sort of view of how Microsoft should move forward? And I don't just mean things that are good with Microsoft, but where would you like Microsoft to improve? How would you like to see Microsoft change to improve these relations with open source, to improve interoperability, and all the things you work towards?
That's a good question. I think, you know, if I had a short list, it would be transparency is a big one for me. Making our processes and the way that we not just not just code, but the process of building a piece of software, making that more transparent to our developers, to end users, to people who are interested in our software. I think probably the greatest asset of the open source phenomenon overall is the role of the community. And I think Microsoft has a tremendous capability to find a way to bring value to that community as well as to participate in the open source community a little bit more effectively. You know, long term, you know, my vision for Microsoft is that it stays a successful commercial business. I have no vision where Microsoft should become sort of a non-profit organization or anything like that. It stay a commercial because I am an employee and a shareholder.
Sure, yeah.
So I have a vested interest in that. But to do it to take some of its capabilities and understand the capabilities of the open source software process and find a way to develop more opportunities together versus just and what I mean by that, building more bridges versus just trying to always have, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum on either beliefs or products or whatever it may be. There's always going to be competition, but I actually think we can have more opportunities and build more bridges in the future than we have in the past.
Bill, we're kind of running out of time here.
Okay.
Now, there's loads of questions I know that we've all got for you, but earlier on in the interview, you said that you listen to Lug Radio. I was just wondering, does Lug Radio have a big listenership at Redmond?
Well, that's a good question. I knew you were going to ask that.
Don't lie to us.
I think probably my guys listen to it. When I was coming over here to jump on the phone, I asked a couple of my guys on my team. I was telling them what I was going to do, and they said, oh, yeah. They listened to an interview, I think, with Miguel de Caza at one point.
Ooh.
You guys do an interview with him.
Cool. Yeah.
Something around Open Solaris at some point. So I think my team does.
Right.
The broader audience, I couldn't speak for. I don't
know.
Does
Bill listen to it? Does Bill Gates?
Does Bill listen to it?
Oh, I do, yeah.
As in Bill G. I don't believe you.
You know you want to convince him. Okay, so just very briefly before we go, you've got, 20,000 Lug Radio listeners here listening to you. This is your captive audience.
How many?
What do you want to say to them? With 30 seconds, what do you want to say to the Lug Radio audience?
Well, besides the fact that I just got my Xbox 360 and that you should all go buy one immediately when
I go
to your local store. I'm a big gamer. So.
Is that free bucks?
Besides that, I say give Microsoft a chance on where it's at today. A lot of times when I talk with people out in the open source community, they're talking about Microsoft 10 years ago. I'm saying you could still have the same belief. You may change your belief, but you should evaluate Microsoft, its products, where we're at in our positioning today, and give us a shot at understanding where we're at today and not always holding us over the water based on, you know, 15 years ago or so.
Bill, it really annoys me. It must annoy you. Do you get really pissed off when they put a dollar sign in the word Microsoft?
Oh, I've seen it all. I've seen it.
That really knocks me off.
Yeah, I mean, it shows up a lot, especially on /.. You see that quite
yeah.
a lot. Yeah.
Oh, Bill, it's been absolutely fantastic having you on. Thanks very much for coming along.
Yeah, cheers, Bill.
I just want to know where I send my resume. anyway, thanks very much.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Nice one, Bill.
We hope that little firm, Microsoft, does well. And,
can we catch up?
maybe we could catch up with you in the future sometime.
You bet. Thanks for taking the time.
Brilliant.
Thanks
again.
Thanks.
Take care, Bill.
Thanks
bye. Much, Bill.
Cheers, bye.
It's time.
Yes.
Oh
yeah, Thunderbirds.
Hypershite!
Not Thunderbirds.
What are we hypershiting tonight?
Oh, that was loud.
Tonight.
That was bloody loud.
Tonight, Matthew.
You got my ears in.
Tonight, we'll be hypershiting Myth TV.
Yeah. Is it Myth or is it TV?
Is it Myth or is it TV? I suspect it may be not. I suspect it may be Myth and not TV, but Jono, tell us about
is
Myth
Odin?
TV.
Well, currently it's partly TV.
So a myth, right, is a female moth, right?
It's a South African moth.
Ah, right.
It's a myth.
No, it's a teacher in school with a lisp.
Anyway, Myth
yes,
TV.
Myth. Do we really need to recap what Myth TV is? Could anybody on the planet not know what Myth TV is?
I think
is?
Many people could do.
I think some people won't know what it is. Myth TV is a piece of software which turns a PC into a home entertainment system.
A home entertainment system.
Yep. What does it do? Put like a couple of cassette recorders?
Like a TiVo box, yeah?
and a neon light down the side.
It's essentially a TiVo box.
Basically, yeah. And it allows you to record TV, pause live TV, play DVDs. You can look at the weather. You can read
newspapers. If only we knew someone who was building one.
Yeah, because this is important. You could also, you know, maybe play a couple of games and read some RSS feeds.
I think it'd be
perfect. And play Tetris at the same time.
Well, you can't play any games if you're running Ubuntu.
Oh, Smith serves you right.
Booked in Ubuntu. Yes. not that I'd want to play any ROMs or anything.
So should we have the case for the defence first, Jono?
Thank you very much.
Is Myth TV
hype? You seem to be making the assumption that.
And is it shite?
Don't talk over each other. We've been told off for that.
Have we? By who?
Some bloke.
By some whiner on the phone.
Some
shut up.
Whining shit. Shut up. We should get them to ring in and then talk over them.
Yeah. 0870 930 1730.
Is that the number?
931.
I had a terrible thought for a second. You were giving out my home phone number.
Jono, I've got a question to ask you. Myth TV, is it hype or shite?
I think it's amazingly a mixture of the two.
Height. I'm getting hangy this time.
Shipe.
Skype. Don't confuse
so,
me.
So, I installed it on
you're in the process of installing it.
I've built a bit of a beast. Luckily, my boss was giving me loads of stuff. He gave loads of stuff away because he's got all kinds of.
Is that stop you soon for the sexual harassment?
Yeah, he touched me in my swimsuit area.
And you liked it
anyway. He gave me some a motherboard and some processor and some other bits and pieces. And I bought one of those. I bought one of those Silverstone cases.
You know, what do you mean one like, of those silver
stone? Silvia like, Stone.
Yeah, it's
cases.
Like a this HPCFP case or whatever they call it.
Oh, they look like a massive VCR.
Yeah. And
like a 1970 VCR.
The summary of it is that I mean I've set it up and it's a bitch to install. It really is. An absolute bitch to install. And it's still not fully 100% working.
How long has
but
it taken?
But it is undeniably cool.
Can you tell us why it's a bitch to install? Because people often say that about it, and I think, well, why?
You see,
Jono, don't you just get installed with TV?
You see, that's what you think, isn't it? until you realise you've got to manually compile LIRC drivers,
which is the infrared remote control.
Yes, and the LCD driver for the little thing on the front of the case. It's good so long as you've got. If I had a case that was didn't have an LCD display and had a really well-established infrared thing, as in it was a couple of years old and there's drivers already established, then it wouldn't be a problem. The stuff I had to do was take patches and patch the code to make it work, right?
Whoa.
And that was...
Bear with me, not only did you get loads of free shit, you got loads of really, really up-to-date advanced free shit.
Yeah, the case I bought...
Right.
I'm ashamed to say I spent £180 on a case.
On an empty case?
I don't pay that for a suitcase.
It's cool.
I wouldn't pay that for a fucking video, which is what you've got.
But yeah, it was a bitch to set up. Once you've got the hardware drivers working, Myth TV itself is fairly easy to set up. But getting the actual remote control thing working and getting the...
I think that's true of most things, isn't it? Yeah. Once you've got the drivers working.
But the software itself...
As I understand it, you know, getting a great big pile of gold in your back garden is a bastard. But once you've got one, you're really rich.
You sarcastic.
And then you pay someone else to set it up for you.
But yeah, so you think it's a bit of both then, really?
It's a bitch to set... It's the same as VoIP that we said last time.
No, it isn't.
It's a bitch to set up, but it's great once it's working.
May I just say you can do VoIP in like... half an hour.
You can do VoIP with Myth TV.
A lot of shit was said about VoIP in this episode.
You see? That's the point. It says so you can pause live television and make phone calls and play games and read RSS feeds and check the weather.
It's a computer that's linked to your TV instead of up to a...
For the...
Hang on, I was talking there.
I was going clockwise.
The offence.
Well, clockwise, that'd be you next then, Mr. Bald.
Ah, shit.
What do you think, Baldaroo?
I think it's, an amazing product. It looks really cool. Project, but I think it's just far too complex. It's taken you, 2 weeks? And you're a coder. It's taken you 2 weeks to even
let's
get
this
halfway
in, let's
set
put this
up.
In perspective. I took a week off work to do it.
Exactly, so it's way too complex at the moment.
And it still wasn't done at the end of that week.
The end result is fantastic, undeniably, and geek points, absolutely, totally.
Yeah, that's a big thing.
Okay, So I think it's hype, basically.
I don't think it's hype or shite. I think it's you know.
I don't remember asking.
It's okay.
It's pleasing.
People were looking at me, so I decided to talk. Yes, it's pleasing. My main problem with Myth TV is that, yes, it takes a long time to set up. Yes, it seems to be a bit of a bitch and everything. My main problem with it, though, is that for the money, and I'd have to offset that against lost geek points, but for the money, I could get myself a really decent off-the-shelf PVR.
Yeah.
That would link up...
You mean, you either, say that about
hang on,
most
hang
things,
on, hang on, hang on. That would either link up directly to my Sky system, now I know yours switches Sky Channels for you, or to my cable system, and has like two or three separate tuners in, and we'll record whatever, whenever, and I just plug and play. Now, that is my main problem with it, is that I just... Personally, I love the idea of dinner, but I just don't think I've got the time in my life or the energy to sit there
fiddling. I think that's probably true about building most things. I mean, you could probably buy them off the shelf for free anyway, but building it yourself, as you say, it's geek points.
Yeah, so.
Then understanding how it works.
It's a hobbyist project.
Absolutely,
that you do.
Yeah. I mean,
it's, you're never going to do it because it's cheaper. It's like the whole thing of building your own computer.
I never said no. I'm just saying I don't think
because it's cheaper.
I think Matt's point is that if you just wanted a PVR and that's it, and you didn't want to punce around setting one up, then it's not suitable. It's not
if,
like
if you didn't want to take 2 weeks off work.
Yeah,
to record TV.
If you didn't want to, you know, like if you, you know, like for example, you can install Ubuntu or Fedora with pretty much. You know, it's fairly fluid.
You mean this show also supports Fedora?
Occasionally.
what do you think, Myth TV?
I'll be honest with you. I don't think it's either. I don't think it's been hyped enough. I think it's bloody fantastic, Myth TV.
Right.
Hang on, it
involves some work, so I thought you weren't going to like it.
No, hang on, bear with me. The point that's been made is absolutely the truth. If what you want is a PVR... Don't get a Myth TV box, because the box you have to buy is insanely expensive. You know, you say, oh, you can just run it on any old PC, and you look at the people on the... there's a database, a PVR database, and it says, I'm running Myth TV, I'm running Freevo, and I've got a P75 with 128 megs of RAM, and it works fine for me. Yeah, my fucking chin. Right, you need a really powerful processor and loads of RAM, and ideally a...
Video capture card, rather than doing it in software.
Otherwise, it's dog slow and doesn't work.
I don't know. Just to interject, I don't.
Even if you've got that,
I don't think that's necessarily true, because you could build a reasonable PVR on a budget. I think you could build.
It's on a budget of £500.
No, screen quality would be crap, though.
No. If you could get a reasonably low spec machine and a shit hot capture card. I mean, I bought. When I set this up, I wanted
which is like 400 or 500 quid on its own.
No, it's not. Because when I set this up, I wanted the dog's bollocks in terms of everything in the machine. Because I've been wanting to do this.
You're getting most of it for free anyway.
As Apple will tell you, I've been wanting to do this for about 2 or 3 years.
Oh, yes.
And I've never got round to it. And so I bought the best PVR card you can get, the hardware encoder.
The 350.
And that, the 350. And that was like 120 quid. It's not much for the best you can get. So, you know... You could sacrifice on the initial machine and put a good PVR card in.
Yeah.
But you know, see, I'd love to find out if someone can build a Myth TV box that runs well for the same money that you could buy a Sky Plus box for.
You could.
That'd be an interesting challenge.
Plus 10 quid a month.
There's kind of two sides to it. I see Matt's point about six sides to it. If what you want to do is just buy a PVR. You know, you just want to be able to plug it in and pause live TV, get Sky Plus box.
It's not so much that. That's not so much my point. My point is more that I would like to be able to do it, but at the moment I think it's too much of a hurdle to justify.
It's a slightly less of a hurdle,
then I might do it.
I suspect there
are... on a weekend.
Yeah, I suspect there are Myth TV people out there going, why aren't you using Knop Myth? Or whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
does that exist, by the way?
Yeah, why aren't
yes,
you,
it does.
Right, okay.
The reason why I didn't use Knop Myth, and part of the reason why I wanted to build a Myth TV box...
Or Myth at home.
Is because I wanted to hack a box together. I enjoy setting it up.
Hacking a box?
Yeah, in the same way that I enjoy hacking on my website and not using WordPress.
Yeah.
It's because end product isn't the only reason why I build it. It's because I enjoy the process of building
totally,
it.
Yeah.
The real benefit... that I think Myth TV and stuff like that gives you is really that because it's a real computer rather than a nice isolated box with nice rounded corners and a display on the front, you can do things like bang a web server in it. And then you can record programs over the web if you want to, which is brilliant. Can't do that with Sky Plus.
No, that is good.
And I mean, I know I've taken the piss out of the fact that you can read RSS feeds on it and play Tetris and do VoIP and all that. And I'm not necessarily clear that all these things are good. And I think there are too many people spending too much time writing
stupid
plugins for it. But on the other hand, it is great that you've got that flexibility. It's just, like Matt says, it is too hard to set up at the moment. But I don't think it's been hyped... Because I think it's not been hyped enough, and as more people get into it, you'll go from the Myth TV you've got now to, you know, they'll do what Ubuntu and Fedora have done. They'll make it easy to install, so you'll just drop it in and stuff will work, and then it'll be great.
Just a quick question: Has anybody? There seems to be a bit of a cult within Myth TV circles of doing this with a mini IT Xbox.
Yeah.
Why didn't you do it with a mini IT Xbox? Was it because there just wasn't enough room to get the cards in?
The primary reason was the fact that my, like I say, I was given a motherboard, and I was given a processor, and I was given a hard drive, and...
And they weren't half-height ones.
And they're all ATX. I could have stacked them on the side, but I don't mind having a large box for it, because I'm replacing a video recorder and a DVD player.
Yep.
So, and there's plenty of room in my home entertainment system. And this is a long-term thing. I'm going to keep it there, and I'm going to use it. I mean, the one thing that I think what Axe just said is important is the fact that because it's a computer, not only does it allow you to do lots of other bits and pieces, like I'm going to plug a webcam in so we can look at the dogs when we're at work, see if they're all right.
Right.
You know, that's an example of it. Having a PC in the living room is handy for things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's also the fact that it's always going to be upgradable. You know, down the line... You know, yeah, you got to, if you want to get a new Sky Plus box,
that's a good point.
Know,
yeah,
you know, with this, I'm always going to be able to upgrade it,
absolutely,
and I love tracking software and getting the new stuff and getting it working.
I think Myth TV boxes at this stage are for the sort of people who would rather buy an MP3 player that isn't an iPod because they can do more things with it.
Yeah,
something that might
it's
play
for hackers.
Something that might work as a USB. Hard drive, something you can put your private keys on, all that kind of thing. You know, if what you want is an iPod, you just want to plug it in and have it work, but you want to read an e-book on it, you can't, and that doesn't bother you, then do it.
Don't strictly agree, simply because I've got an iRiver, and I don't want to build my TV box, so you fall down.
No, I fall down.
So, that's the end of Hypershite, then.
It is.
We said three of three.
Is it?
If you'd like any more, then please write in with the subject line, Hypershite.
Is it Hypershite?
Poor old Matt's been eating cold chips again.
Your microphone stand's fallen down.
If anybody was
there, like let us know if you want to keep this segment.
Yeah,
tell us. Show at lugradio.org.
A few episodes ago, we talked about what we needed on Linux, and Matt was saying that one of the things that we needed was proper business software. Is that right, Matthew?
That's right.
Absolutely.
Accountancy software in particular.
So we set this on the forums, and people suggested TurboCash.
TurboCash!
Version 7.0?
7.0!
And this is one of those products or projects that's actually started out as a commercial product.
And has been going for about 20 years.
And has been going for a very long time, and has gone open source recently. But it's a Windows-only product at the moment.
Yes.
I think we should have a chat to the bloke what is behind it.
Yep. And who he?
Flip. Copeman.
Philip Copeman
from sunny Cape Town.
Nice.
Hello.
Hi, Philip. It's Matthew from Lug Radio.
Hi, Matthew.
Hi, we've also got Jono, Aid, and Stuart here.
How can I help you?
Well, you're the lead developer of TurboCash, am I right?
I'm not the lead, I'm the project manager.
Okay, now, a couple of episodes ago, we were talking about software that we felt was necessary but missing from the open source world, and one of those was a fully-fledged accounting package. One of our listeners wrote in to tell us that TurboCash existed, so we came along and had a look at your website, and we thought we'd just ring you up and have a chat about it. As I understand it, TurboCash has been around for quite some time, but long before it was open source, so what made you decide to take TurboCash open source?
Well, it was kind of after, you know, we had the big Y2K boom in the year 2000, and after that I kind of found myself stuck in South Africa in a sideline market up against really big international competitors, and we were going nowhere. And then one of the things I saw was using these open source components which we used for development.
Right.
I found that they were actually better than the things we were paying hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, hundreds of dollars for, and that kind of led me towards it. And then I started reading up the literature, and we decided to make that move. And in 2003, we changed. So I'd been up for 20 years. I've been a commercial developer, just like Sage or QuickBooks. So then we decided to change to open source then.
Right. So how's that impacted your business? I mean, I imagine that the ongoing development costs are still fairly high for your company. So how has that had an impact on what all the Americans call
it?
Well,
it's really scary in the beginning. We nearly went out of business, because what you've got is you've got a business where people are paying you money every month. You go open source, and the first people that take the program for free are the people that were paying you.
Right.
And then it kind of so it slumps, and you think, wow, okay, we've blown it here. And then as it picks up, you get a whole new group of people that arrives, and they start coming in their thousands every month.
Really?
And then it's a business after that.
How do you make a business out of it, though? Because you can download it for free from the website. So where does your income come from?
All right, so there's a whole string of, it's not a utility software or software that you chuck away. Accounting software is mission critical software. So there's a whole range of services that go with it.
Yeah.
So we have 200 or 300 people that live purely off just supporting TurboCash systems.
Wow.
So if you're sitting in Australia in Sydney and you have a problem, you call our guy there, he drives out down the bay and he comes and he fixes it for you.
Okay. All right.
So there's a living to be made. In the same way as you have a Sage agent or a QuickBooks agent, there's a living to be made for someone who wants to do support on an open source package, and it's mission critical. So we, in the same business as the commercial packages like that.
Cool. One of the reasons for going open source must be the fact that you're going to get other people contributing to the code and looking through the code. How have you found that?
I read the Cathedral and the Bazaar, and I went off, and that's what set me going. But it's surprising that the kind of person that you get, it's not, you don't get them, it's not programmers that come, funnily enough.
Really?
I do have programmers.
Okay.
But I get a group of pseudo-programmers, or people that are
translators,
accountants, people that work in tax offices, and quite strangely, they're not young people. I find a lot of retired people coming to me, or guys that have got private incomes, they've been working in a particular thing, and this is like a hobby to them.
So they're asking
for... You can imagine that they're people that have tax as a hobby.
Are they asking for features, or are they supplying code?
They do ask me for features, but they supply me with solutions. It's not... let's say it's pseudocode. He'll come to me and he'll say, look, this is how we work on tax in Croatia. I was dealing with one this evening. So, and he's a particular sort of communist-oriented country, so he's got a particular way that he works.
Right.
He says, we need to do this or this or this, and then he specifies it.
Hmm.
And so there's a lot, and then accounting has got a lot of little problems that you've got to stamp out, these thousands and thousands of bugs that come from the guy using it in whatever different situation that comes up. So the coding and the actual writing Pascal code is a minor part of the project.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. The major thing that, the major players in this field, you're obviously competing with them. Do you think that going open source has made you a better competitor? Are you shipping more copies of your software out to them, out to the public?
Yeah, no doubt about that. I mean, I'm essentially the only one that's done this. So that it's almost like we have a monopoly now in the open source business.
Right.
Because the other guys are like, they're locked into their own assets and their own databases.
Sure, yeah.
And so we have a completely different strategy to them. Their products cost like £1,000 to deliver to market. And ours comes in at like $1 a piece. And so, it makes us very, very competitive at the moment, and I'm pleased. If you look at our downloads, it's publicly open information. You can see it. We're growing rapidly.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, a lot of people who listen to the show are Linux aficionados, and they're going to be wanting to know if a port is going to be available. So, just summarising, where do you see the future of this going, and is Linux in the horizon?
Look, we're Linux supporters. I mean, you're like basically open source brothers to us, but the operating system is not my battle. It's hard enough taking on Sage and QuickBooks in the accounting business.
Yeah, sure.
The operating system business has to play itself out, really. Now, the problem that we have is that whereas you may have like a 10% desktop penetration in Linux in general, in the accounting business, it's like 1%.
Yeah, yeah.
Now this is really difficult. This makes it really difficult for us because, I mean, if any resources that we put into it, we've got a 10 times bigger hit in Windows than we do in Linux.
Of course, yeah.
So yes, I talked to the distribution managers and I'm looking for a joint venture. But it's not a simple matter. And otherwise this would exist. If you could just go out and knock it together in a couple of months, there would be a Linux accounting package like this.
Do you believe that there's some mileage in redevelopment, in making sure that it'll run on all operating systems from a single code base?
No. My feeling on that is the opposite, is that I think that what we have to do with Linux is we have to write a Linux version.
Right.
You have to be very specific. There are these PHP-type programs that drift across from one to another,
but
they look terrible.
If
anything that's transported from Linux onto Windows, it just looks really, really bad.
That's a fair
people
point, yeah.
get... I'd say Windows owns the mindshare. They get a particular way in which they work with Windows programs.
Sure.
And so when we write for Windows, we write to optimize it for Windows.
Right.
Now, the same thing must happen again. We must write to optimize for Linux. I'm not a believer in the carryover. I just haven't seen really good apps that work in these mission-critical things that carry over.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you should check out Firefox.
I don't know. Firefox is great. So you say that's written in one version?
Yeah, pretty much. From what I can tell, it's. I think there's individual bits where it ports over, but I think the basis of what you're saying is totally true. That there's a lot of carryover stuff that's not particularly good in either platform.
The key to it is a grid. It's you've got to have a means of managing transactions in a database, like a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
So you've got to be more like OpenOffice. Now, as I understand it, they've got two codes.
Right.
OpenOffice
is from a single code base.
That it should be two, but I want to get it, and anyone in your community that wants to help me, I'm there. Just
Fantastic.
Tell them to get hold of me. I'm my door's open. I'm willing to do it.
So this is the chance for the Lug Radio community. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and we hope that people from our community can come on and help you out and get it moving. Thank you so much for coming on.
I love your program, man. It's hilarious. I'm a fan now.
Nice to know we've got a fan.
Wicked. Thanks very
Philip.
Much.
Thank you.
Cheers, Matthew.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Open source software, free software. Is it commercial at times? Is it not? Why do you write free software if you are a developer? Is it for financial gain? Is it for kudos amongst your community?
Breathe, Matthew, breathe.
Now, the reason I'm asking these questions is basically that...
It's because we've decided to talk about this.
Yeah. I've noticed a couple
I've
noticed a couple of occurrences where you've got a free software project that suddenly realised that it's got a lot of bills to pay for the bandwidth for its website or
such
whatever
as
else.
What kind of bill?
Maybe
bill
for its
health.
Maybe about
no. maybe for its website bandwidth.
That's
maybe
a bill to pay.
Maybe or a couple of $100 of sort of website.
Maybe, right? Maybe, yeah. That's one example.
They should go to fast hosts.
Shut up. Here's the thing, right? They're a good company. Here's the thing. Where is it reasonable for an open source project to go to its user base and say, "We need your financial or other support," and then to, if it isn't forthcoming in the way they want, is it reasonable for them to start saying, "Well, we won't play ball anymore"?
When they've exhausted all other possibilities. So,
yeah.
I mean, for instance, as Jono said earlier when we were talking, we've managed to do this on a shoestring. I mean, yeah, we get donations from the public, but, you know...
Not anymore. We've stopped that now.
Yeah, we have. Absolutely. So we're like open source community, and we survive with little money.
We built it up by being fairly nice and everything like that to people.
But we're a podcast show. I mean, a lot of podcast shows, their biggest expense, they say, is their bandwidth. But
and our bandwidth.
We built a magnificent mirror network.
The mirror network is brilliant.
It's genius.
Let's not sit here gloating about how great we are.
No, let's do that. Can we do that for a bit first?
But it's really got nothing to do with others. It's got everything to do with the freaking mirrors.
So my point is...
Thank you, our mirrors.
When is it... okay for them to go to their public and ask for money? Well,
yeah,
the answer is when they've run out of any other choice.
All right, okay. So do you think it's all right then for a company to, for an open source project to say, right, we've run out of all other options. Otherwise, if you don't do what we want, we'll stop producing software or we'll cripple it. I mean, the other week we were talking about Sediga with their trans gaming product.
Sediga?
Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Yep.
They say
that... It used to be YNAX.
Isn't that a big mobile home?
Shush, we haven't got time.
Okay.
They say that... That's a Winnebago. They say that if you
isn't that like a bun sort of
thing? What?
That's a bagel.
Cinnamon bun, yeah.
A Winnebago. I'd like to win a bagel.
Me too, as well. I'd rather win a Winnebago. I wonder if Winnie Mandela had a Winnebago.
Back to the point.
Anyway, here's the thing, right? If you're one of those... they said that if you package up binaries of their source code, they'll stop producing their product.
They'll go home and take their ball with them.
Basically,
their closed ball.
So, is that okay? What I'm trying to say
is, it isn't okay.
When is it all right for open source projects to start really demanding things from their user
base?
Open
source and then demand that everybody doesn't package up your binaries. Technically you can,
what Sediga have done, because from their perspective, the way they see it, people start packaging up the binaries, then they'll lose their revenue stream, at which point, why the hell should they carry on developing it, so other people can take the benefit of it?
Now, I'll buy a different mobile home if it comes to that.
That's against the open source ideals, absolutely.
It depends whether we're talking about a... what I, you know, a totally non-profit project. I don't think Sidiga are necessarily the best example of an open source project that because they've got a business model that bases around it, and that complicates the matters.
So I suppose it depends on the community. But in terms of how much do they want the software?
I think in terms of most projects, development projects that are creating a piece of software can get by with the bounty,
a little help from their friends,
with the bounty of services we've got on the internet. SourceForge aren't particularly great all the time, but they provide a place to do this. Collab.net
bounty, you say?
There's also others, isn't there? Like the one that the
chocolate or
there's,
milk.
Savannah, which the GNU people set up, and there's Tigris.
So,
I mean, to take hosting as an example, there are plenty of those things. The thing really is that if you've got, if you're running an open source project and you're having difficulty meeting whatever needs you've got, whether they be hosting or bandwidth bills or whatever you need, and you reach out to your community and your community don't respond, maybe you didn't have that much of a community to begin with. I don't want to be mean here, but, you know, the Lug Radio team, here we are. We reached out to our community, and we had loads of people say, yeah, we'll run Mirror Networks, because we tried to make it really easy for them to do so.
And the point...
And they have done that, so the community did respond.
And we didn't have a victim attitude, mentality. It wasn't a case
we
of...
We didn't say...
Oh, if you don't do it, we'll stop doing the show.
The thing is, as well, is that...
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. It's how you ask, isn't it?
I suspect, absolutely. I suspect critics of what Axe just said might say, well, yeah, but you started out and loads of people started listening to the show because it's Lug Radio and they like Lug Radio and it was easy. But it wasn't, because when we started doing the show, no fucking listened to us whatsoever. It was like any other open source project.
That's right.
Oh, my massive chinny Boris. So, yeah, we went from scratch as much as anybody else. And I think if we can do it,
The other thing, if you look at some of the open source projects or some of the web projects that have been built by people and they got bought up by sort of Yahoo or whatever, you look at Flickr or Delicious or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the people who built those things, they got a massive payout and got to go and work for Yahoo and so on.
Yeah.
But almost always you'll find that they spent the previous year running it and paying the bandwidth bills out of their own pockets because they believed in what they were doing.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, but it's not just about money, though, okay? What about skills? Now,
it's about the women as well, isn't it?
It's about the women and the drugs.
Popeye the Sailor Man, whenever I go swimming, I kiss all the women. So here's the thing, right? You've got...
What the fuck are you talking about?
You've got the various skills that are involved in...
Meat skills.
Mad skills.
Yeah, my mad skills. In packaging up the product, marketing it, doing PR, spreading it around, you know...
Marketing.
Distribution, all of that stuff, right?
So, sorry, what was that?
When is it all right? We spoke to possibly earlier in the show or later in the show, there will be an interview with a guy from TurboCash. And from within that interview, he mentioned that someone from Croatia, earlier in the evening, sent him some details of the tax system in Croatia.
Yeah.
Now, that's great. And the reason that's happened is because for 20 years, he's built up a user base. So how do we have any tips for how open source projects can build up a community of people who are willing to get involved?
I've got one. Here it comes.
Go on.
Speak the wisdom of the bald.
Hit us with your tip.
Here it is. If you build it, they will come.
Yeah,
wow.
Maybe.
I am so inspired to be in front of your reflective head.
I'm in fact inspired by your bald commentary. I think a lot of that is if you are decent to your user base, if your users come in and say, you know, we'd like to help you here, don't say, well, no, you'll help me the way I want you to help.
Yeah.
If they say, we'd like to do this, you say, okay, let's get involved, let's work as a community. You can't ask the community for help and draw on the community if it's not a community, but a dictator
and a lone
subject. It
needs to be two-way, yes.
But it's interesting, though, how some communities do work in a more sort of dictatorial fashion, because some people
they work or they don't work.
They do work,
right?
Because some communities are basically pushed by one person. And then I've experienced people talk about that one.
And then
person.
You invade his country and put him on charge.
That's
on trial.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
And he looks like a jazz singer.
Does he have any oil?
Well, I'm not going there.
He looks like Mario. If you ask me.
What, Saddam?
Yeah.
He doesn't.
Hey.
What?
Anyway, sorry.
Radio gag. But yeah, I mean, some... I don't think there's...
Pull it together, Jono. Come on, you can do it. Come on.
I don't think there's one...
Use the force. Come on, Jono, you can do it.
I can't.
You can't. Believe in yourself. Come on.
There's not one. There's no one way of a community working. You know,
shit a mushroom.
You shat a mushroom.
I did that once.
Communities work in different ways, don't they? And there's no kind of formula for the way it works. So I think it's, I can understand why some communities totally fail, because they haven't got a fucking clue of how open source works.
Yeah.
And you've got to, you've really, I think a lot of people sort of go from cold and have never really contributed to a project.
Talk about cold. Mm.
And then they, you know, then they just go straight forward and think they can run a community and get absolutely nowhere very quickly.
I think running a community is a skill in itself, really. Mm.
And you've got to learn from other people how to
absolutely
do that.
And from your own mistakes.
And use the force.
You have got to use the force.
So if you've got any thoughts on this, show at lugradio.org, cast your thoughts towards our pod.
Okay, so it's the end of the show. Time for the emails and for the voicemails.
How are you feeling, mate? Are you feeling all right?
I'm amazed I've made it this far.
Well done. You've done a good job, mate.
You're a hero. Good stuff. How many voicemails have we had, boys?
None.
None.
No voicemails.
Damn you lot. What's the number?
0870-931-1730.
So you've got no excuse.
No. Don't look at me. I'm here.
You've got no excuse.
Okay. Right.
Okay. Emails, let's go back to emails.
Emails.
Now, you'll forgive me if I don't read too many, because, as you know, I'm not a well man. I'm going to start with a nice short one from Mr. Yonkeltron.
Yonkers.
And he sends us some hugs and kisses.
Ooh. Wow. Thanks, Yonk.
And he says, I'm at college now, and listening to Lug Radio while studying is an excellent distraction. I miss you all on Hash Lug Radio and hope to chat to you soon.
Fantastic.
That's pound Lug Radio for you Americans.
Okay, I've had an email from...
And if you're on a Mac, it... Well,
shit. Yeah. Presumably you have to go and find a hash symbol somewhere on the internet and then cut and paste it.
Yeah. All you Mac users. Dear sir, this is from Espen Stein. Weird email address. Dear sir, gnome is pronounced with a hard G. It seems as if you don't know this or don't care.
Don't
thank
mean
you for your time.
Gnome.
To be honest, I think you'll find this the latter.
Don't care. Thank
no,
you very much.
No, I mean, I get the impression he's asking us if we're apathetic or just ignorant, and I think we don't know and we don't care.
Who says it's spelled that way?
Pronounced that way.
No. Best that pronunciation
well, when
I heard
we spoke to J-Dub, he kind of pronounced it that way.
Gnome.
Did you know that the Spanish...
Fair comment.
The Spanish pronounce it... Genome.
Genome.
Which is brilliant. Fire away.
Yep. Got an email here from a bloke called Aaron Newcomb, who says, glad you're back with the new episodes. He was going through withdrawal during the break, but presumably heroin withdrawal.
We have a live drum.
Sorry,
kit.
It was a bit of a delay there.
Honestly, it's not worth trying.
It's a real drum kit as well.
He says he's working on a new video podcast called The Source, or possibly The Underscore Source.
Or sample.
Which will be about using open source at home and for business. And do we have any helpful suggestions for him?
Yeah.
Be nice to your listeners.
Helpful suggestion number two, don't do a video podcast.
And just set up a Weblog radio mirror instead.
What's his website address?
He hopes to have the first episode up by the end of the year at thesourceshow.org.
Look forward to seeing it.
Fair play.
Yeah, cool.
Absolutely fantastic. Good job. We'd like to see that.
Okay, nice one. Who's next? Me.
Blue Vein Matt.
Got an email here from...
Jeff, isn't that your jazz name?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Jeff Stachnik. His email's gambling in America. He just quickly says that basically, yes, you're right, the gambling is illegal in most states, but there are loopholes. For example, I live in Illinois and there's a casino in my town, but it's on a boat. So for some reason, if it's on a boat, it's okay.
That's true.
And he says, if people are not allowed to gamble in their own home, but hey, people do anyway. Keep the good shows coming, Jeff Stachnik.
All right, nice one, Jeff. Presumably, you know, if you can't find a boat, you can always hold a glass of water while you were playing poker. Well, something that would be all right.
You crazy American. Hey,
yeah. I'm here all week.
Oh, I don't know about reading emails.
Try the tiramisu.
Geeky reading is a subject of the next email. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Love the show.
Hi. Who's
love
it from?
The show. It makes working with fucking MS Access bearable for an hour every couple of weeks. Although, I don't know about all this rampant Ubuntu love. Maybe it's just because I can't afford any hardware that's more than 5 years old. Doesn't he mean any hardware that's less than 5 years
old? Oh, hang on.
Wait for it.
I was sorry. I was so excited. I clumped my drumsticks.
Give us a bit of metal.
Hey?
Nice. Metal, yeah, proper.
Anyway. That's enough. He goes on to say he's just read, and we'll insert a tiny
he's just learned to read,
I'm sure. Yeah. And top 20 geek novels. And he said he seemed to vaguely remember one of us talking about The Cuckoo's Egg.
Yes. Yep.
And he was wondering if any of us had any more recommendations for some more crackers.
We haven't got time, sorry.
Jacobs. Wow.
Yeah, wow.
much.
Yes,
Jake.
Thank you.
Oh, no, I mean, one each, very, very quickly.
Snow Crash.
No, oh, bollocks.
Does it have to be about computers?
The Revolution in the Valley.
Does it have to be
Revolution in the Valley.
A novel.
Geek. Oh, a novel.
Yeah. You said novels.
Novel.
Geeky novels, yeah.
I don't read novels.
Vert by Jeff Noon, or whatever his name was.
Microsurfs.
Neuromancer.
Spaz. I can't think of anything because I was going to say both of those two. Oh, Count Zero.
Fight Club is
the life and times of the village people.
Right, let's crack on.
Okay.
Rapid Development by Steve McConnell, having just read it off of Jono's bookshelf.
Yeah, and I gave you a free copy of that as well.
And it's shite, so don't buy it.
The reason why I gave you that copy is because a few chapters were missing, incidentally.
Crack on, crack on.
Okay, we've had an email from Scott Graban, who's also posted to the forums. He says, "Hi, I'm Scott Graban."
Hi, Scott.
We've already established that, Scott. Thank you very much. I'm the developer for CastPodder, formerly the Linux version of iPodder. The reason for this
Didn't
email
they get sued?
Is because the future of CastPodder development is in serious trouble. Scott's come onto the forums. Bit of a ruckus on the forums.
Ooh.
Everything's settled out now. Everybody's holding hands.
Under what?
On the forums. You may be familiar with them. Ask him if we can support his project with financial donations. All we can do really is say, if anybody wants to donate, go and see the project.
What's the URL?
CastPodder.org.
CastPodder.org.
Okay, nice one.
Thank you very much,
okay,
Scott.
Is it my go next? A mate for an email from my mate Bill, actually, which says, just listen to the radio, slap the bald on the head for not understanding what would happen if BT went out of business. So, Matt, if you could slap the bald on the head. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that.
I love the way I made it time.
I've got a question, Ak. What happened to all those emails saying that you were outrageously wrong about the VoIP thing? They don't appear to be here.
Amazingly enough, they never made it to the studio.
No.
If you don't like that, perhaps
you
ought,
the emails
perhaps
there,
you ought to print the fucking emails out. How about
you
that?
You censorious
censorship.
Right, next one. Number of references to Ubuntu. This is from Daniel Robitaille, who is a Canadian guy, I believe, who is heavily involved
from Canada.
In
Canada.
I've heard of him. Is he an Ubuntu guy?
Documentation guy and rampant Log Radio listener.
Hooray.
Wanted to congratulate you for episode 2 of your third season for finally reaching an appropriate number of references to Ubuntu, Kubuntu, Zubuntu, Edubuntu during an episode. Episode 1 was really disappointing with only 2 small references. Basically, it's just trying to pimp Ubuntu.
The speed reading this week, by the way, guys? You seem to be going at a hell of a pace.
It's just that the world's looking different through your overly flu-infested eyes.
Flu-ridden.
Yeah, it's not that we're reading fast, just your brain is working very slowly, I think.
Or even more slowly than usual.
Go on, guys, let's go.
Matt, it's you. You're a taskmaster.
It's you. It's your turn.
Have you got any more, Aid?
Can you see any emails?
Okay,
I can't say it. We've had a mail from Neelan Murray saying... don't laugh at the name!
Oh, come on.
Sorry, incidentally, Patrick Finch, the guy...
Was his name Neil?
Neelan.
Oh, right.
I think it's Neelan. Patrick Finch, right? The guy who works at Sun, who sorted us out the Adam Leventhal interview.
Oh,
he wanted to know, he sent me an email saying, why the fuck does Aid laugh at my name?
Yeah, why do you laugh at his name?
And I said, I don't know, I'll ask him. So now's as good a time as any. What exactly is wrong with his name?
What is it again?
Patrick Finch.
Thank you very much.
I have no idea why it's funny.
So, anyway, Neelan Murray says, hi,
Neelan
guys. Neelan Murray.
Neelan Murray.
Shut the fuck up. Hi, guys. Nice show. I've listened to all of the shows from season 2 onwards, and it's always a blast. As such, I'd like to allay the fears recently aired of a giant network implosion occurring if everyone switches to VoIP. He basically goes on to say...
Oh, one of them made it through, then.
He basically goes on to say that I was right about everything. Thanks very much.
And I was when I was at home.
Thank you very much, Needle and Haystack, or whatever your name was.
Sorry, change the kit.
Did you misfire, then?
Okay, we've got a mail here from Alex Hudson, who's a Hula guy, and he's offering to do a talk.
The big HUD man.
He's offering to do a talk on Hula at Lug Radio Live.
Good man.
He says he'd be willing to give such a talk, and would we be interested in it? Hell yes, we'd be interested. Thank you very much.
Okay,
yes.
Thanks.
And we'll
a lot.
Get on to Lug Radio Live shortly.
Thank you. Next one is called Beelzebuntu and the like. Dear blokes, chaps, lads, sods, whatever, I listened to my first Lug Radio show today. Funny stuff. And then he gives a link to something.
The link's actually cool. I looked at the
Paul
link.
Paul Bissex.
What he did was he went through the dictionary with grep and found all the words that end in UB.
Oh, right.
And then built Ubuntu variants for them. So for tub, you've got Tubuntu. I'm looking forward to Tub Girl Ubuntu, I think.
We'll link to that in the show notes. So, next one.
I've got a very long mail here, but I'm not going to read the whole
Summarize,
thing.
Summarise, man.
The first one is from Andrew Mason. He says, Jono, which SIP phone did you get? So people can go out
That's
and buy the same
tone,
one.
101.
Yep.
That phone, the Budgetone 101.
You'd be much better off with Linksys PAP2 adapter, though.
Okay.
The SNOM phones are nice as well.
Okay, and then he talks about how we said that Windows XP was faster, and basically says, my fucking chin.
He's fucking so wrong, because it is faster.
No, he says here... chin. He's got he's got two basically identical systems, gig of RAM in each, with Firefox and a dozen tabs open, OpenOffice, Thunderbird, Flash, and Photoshop on the Windows box. It lags like a bitch, and he has to use two or three at a time and keep closing them down.
The actual operating system.
And then he says he's got KDE running with loads of stuff on it. Never has to reboot it. No problem at all.
See, there's his problem, right there.
What KDE?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Next therefore, one. You have to discount anything that he says.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Next one is from David Goodger, who says...
That's not ad, David, is it?
No.
Ah, right.
This confused me.
As in badger, but good. So
badger is good. Badger.
David Badger.
He's pimping his project DocuTils, which is at docutils.sf.net, which contains restructured text. So what you see is what you get, plain text markup language that's taken the Python world by storm, has it?
A lot of Python documentation is written in restructured text. It's another markup thing like Wiki Markup or style or like Markdown.
Have a look at that, people. He says
sounds
it's
like
also
a burger.
A Cub Scouts leader.
What does? Reconstructed meat, isn't
and Canadian.
Reconstituted meat.
But the reason that David Goodger Badger writes to us is so that he's like to plug PyCon Texas 2006.
PyCon?
Python Community Conference taking place in Addison, Dallas, Texas, USA from Friday 24th.
You'll be going the neck.
Through to Friday, February the 26th. You can go to PyCon.org.
Yep, PyCon, a special conference for Pikeys.
It's not
actually. He also says that Ubuntu Blue Zero was really cool in Montreal, and everyone from Ubuntu, including Shuttleworth, seems to be down to earth.
Yep. PyCon will be cool, but it'll be in Texas, so I shan't be going.
Can I?
I've got more emails here.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Just one more.
Go on.
From willwhackforfood.biz or something. It says. Will Hack for Food.
Oh, right.
Disposable email address.
Is his name Will Hack?
What's wrong with this? Basically, he's moaning that there's nothing on the audio / video page of the Lugraithu Live.
It's funny you should say that, because I've edited some of the bits and pieces down.
Well done.
So far, I've done the intro, Rufus Pollock, Mark Shuttleworth, and the Masturbate.
The Masturbate's my favourite bit.
Well, it would be, as you were the person who compared it.
Yep.
Compared it to
a summer's day.
Ah, yes. We're going to make this available to the wider world.
Very shortly.
We're going to stick them on the page, the Lug Radio 2005 audio and video page, where they should have gone months ago. Speaking of which, can I bring the subject to Lug Radio Live 2006?
Yeah, I think we should.
The 2-day extravaganza that is known as.
Lug Radio 2006.
This time now.
Thanks
back.
For filling that.
You're not feeling very well, are you, mate?
Important thing, first of all, Saturday the 22nd and Sunday the 23rd of July 2006.
Wolverhampton Students' Union in Wolverhampton.
Wolfruna Street, is it, or something?
Yes, Wolfruna Street.
Now, on that Saturday night, we're not planning on going out and having any drinks, right?
No. What we're going to do is we're going to have a big fuck-off party in the Students' Union. And it's a really good venue. You'll enjoy it.
This venue that we've booked is basically...
It is
plasma
perfect. Screens.
Last year we had basically a big room, well, a big hot room. And a tiny room on the side for lightning talks. This one we've got, we've basically got four rooms. A
massive
room,
rooms as well, with a bars,
big room,
seats.
With windows that open.
Yeah.
And aircon.
Air conditioning. The whole place is fantastic. It's really comfortable. There's a big bar. It's going to be a superb day. So let's talk about who we've confirmed so far.
Martin Vogel.
Because we've...
Well, we've got the hula guy.
Shall I read the list out?
Do it.
Shall
you
I read the
bitch.
List out? Now, these are just early speakers that we've got, and we've only been doing this for a week or so, so there are many more to come. We've got Jonathan Riddell, who's going to come and do a talk about KD4 and Kubuntu, the Kubuntu Dapper, because Kubuntu is now a pretty big project.
Yeah, Shuttleworth runs
it. It's now an official Ubuntu project.
It is, yeah.
Well.
Mark Shuttleworth uses it, doesn't
it? So, nice one, Riddell.
So, yeah, we're going to have Matthew Block. He's coming down, he's from Bytemark, and he's going to come down and talk about virtualization. Or he said he may talk about Ruby on Rails, he's not sure at the moment.
I could have two Ruby on Rails.
We've got to thank Bytemark, because they're helping us sponsor the event, and they've been really, really, really
very generous of them.
So and they're also rather helped with audio.lugradio.org.
Yeah, they are tremendously supportive of Lug Radio, so go and buy anything that they offer, apart from things that are illegal.
Apart from anything that competes with Fastos.
Shut up. Yeah, when Fastos give us some fucking cash, we can pimp them as well. We've also got Alex Hudson, who we discussed earlier on. He's coming to talk about Hula. Hoola. Yep, so Alec, he's a core developer and he does a lot of the Ubuntu packages. For
oh, nice one. God's good sake. One, Hado.
Yep. Do you have to say Ubuntu in every sentence?
Ubuntu.
I don't know Ubuntu.
Martin Vogel is coming down to talk about Vogel, BBC Action Vogel. Network.
Rice and pea.
Hear me now.
Yep, BBC Action Network. It's
so,
where
so
they,
is he?
It's basically a community organisation type of project, and they're releasing all their code open source soon, so it'll help people to create online communities, basically.
Excellent.
That's all
stuff.
I know about it, really.
Ian Lynch is coming down to talk about Open Document and the Open Document Fellowship.
That'll
nice
be cool.
One. So it's going to be good to have
Fellowship of the Open Document.
Yeah, it's good because we're all... We've
is
also
it a trilogy?
Got,
eh?
Presumably you get the Microsoft thing and then you throw it into the volcano at the end.
We've also got Martin van der Streek, who's Trinax from the forums, who's a very prominent Ubuntu guy. You'll be pleased to know, eight.
He's and coming Dutch. To talk about Ubuntu.
He's coming to talk about Ubuntu. We've got the fantastic Michael Makes is coming down to do a talk about OpenOffice.org.
Hey, Michael
Makes. So we're looking forward to seeing his talk. The mental case, the absolute nutcase, mental case that is Matthew Garrett.
Oh, yes.
He's coming to do a talk. We're going to get him on the show, I think, sometime soon. He's been badgering me like fucking crazy to come on the show.
I don't really know who he is.
He does a lot
Matt
of the
Garrett, he's a nutter from Cambridge.
Yeah, he does a lot of the laptop sort of power management stuff. He's a really sound bloke. I've never seen anyone put so much beer away quite as much as Matthew Garrett as well.
Okay.
John Leach.
Nice one, John
Leach. We like
Leach.
John Leach.
Yep, funny
he's
man.
Going to talk about Everybody Loves Eric Raymond. Elliot Smith, who's a guy I work with. He's coming to talk about Ruby on Rails. Paul Cooper, who's my boss, is coming to talk about something. He's not sure what. I put on the website Open Advantage, but he wants to talk about something more interesting. Tom Steinberg from My Society and Pledge Bank.
He should be good.
Ewan Spence. Speaking of nutters, Ewan Spence is a fine Spence. Example.
He's a heroic nutter, that bloke. He's brilliant. Those of you who went to Open Tech will have seen him do the trick with the iPod shuffles that was not very popular.
It was
with the one guy who had his private key on his iPod shuffle and then lost the shuffle.
He is a very, very funny man. So he's coming to. He's travelling all the way down from the land of haggis. And Christian Schaller is the final
nice
confirmation
bloke.
Who's coming down to talk
who
about
who is a paintball hero, in my opinion.
He seems to be. He's travelling over from
Barcelona.
We've also
with his beautiful horizon.
Did he learn English from a book?
I think
he did. I learned from a book.
And Simon Willison, I believe.
Yes, we've got Simon Willison, who's coming down probably to talk about Django or whatever else he fancies.
Django?
And Drew McClellan's going to come and talk about open source websites and things like that.
O'Reilly have given us loads of prizes again this year.
Thanks a lot.
Which is great. So there's going to be lots of silly competitions. We'll
think some up.
Try not to offend anyone quite as much as Pickle got slain last time. And then we're starting to build up exhibitors. We need you to get involved because we want people to come and do boffs and all kinds of stuff. Go to the little radio.
Explain what a boff is.
A boff, Birds of a Feather session. It's a very sort of informal discussion about anything that you want. We're going to have a number of little boffs.
So it's
areas.
Like a lightning talk, but even more lightning.
Well, it's where people run it themselves.
Right.
Yeah. Take the opportunity if you've been working with people over the net and you'd like the chance to get to meet them. All of you come to Lug Radio Live, meet up, have a beer, talk about whatever your project is.
Let's emphasise, room is not a problem at this event.
Yes.
If you need
space.
Room, we can
space.
Got
a lot
space.
More. A lot more room. Yeah. So if you want to exhibit something, come down. Even if
as long as
it's
not an exhibition of yourself, yeah.
Eh?
Make an exhibition of yourself.
Make an exhibition of yourself. So yeah, so we've got some boff areas. The LAN gaming's been sorted out. There's talk of a tournament going on.
Yep, and there'll be all sorts of shit going on.
It's Violet
Berlin.
It's a day and a half this year.
Yeah. Well, maybe 2 days. Well,
it's 2 days.
And don't forget, there's a big party on Saturday night.
Saturday night.
Party!
No botched curries this year.
Yeah, it's going to be absolutely superb. But we need
maybe
your help.
Those nice people from Red Hat will pay for the curry again.
Hopefully.
Yep. If
maybe
you
they will. Well done, Red Hat, for that last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's wrap it up.
Okay. Do you reckon? All right.
Well, do you want to talk about anything else, Master?
No, that's fine. Thank you very much for listening. It's been a real pleasure.
It has. And we'll see you next episode.
See you next episode.